The idea that reality is whatever we want it to be is, for Lewis, not just soul-killing, but life-killing. It is an error beneath every other error. Lewis's life's project, not just the project of his fiction, but the project of his whole life, even before his conversion, in fact, was to try to restore an awareness of the reality of actual things. Hello, I'm David Whalen, professor of English at Hillsdale College. Today we're going to be discussing the fiction of C.S. Lewis. Let me start with this. In life and art both, as it seems to me, Lewis says in an essay, we are always trying to catch in our net of successive moments something that is not successive. Let me read that again. In life and art both, as it seems to me, we are always trying to catch in our net of successive moments something that is not successive. Now, we'll come back to that, and I know that's a very abstract and difficult thing to understand, but it does, in a sense, provide an introduction to thinking and understanding, thinking about C.S. Lewis's fiction and understanding what he is up to. Lewis is known, of course, for his religious apologetics and for his literary criticism. He was a scholar and an Oxford Don, as I'm sure you know, but he is probably most famous for his children's literature and for his adult space trilogy. These novels are sometimes referred to as fantasy books or fairy tales. Sometimes they have been called science fiction. But what we need to do is discern as best we can what Lewis is up to in his fiction. Now, today we will be speaking about this with the presumption that viewers have read these novels. I am not going to try to paraphrase stories or simply outline plots. I'm going to speak of these things with the assumption that you have read them. If you have not read them, that's not a problem. What I will provide here hopefully will constitute a welcome introduction. The first thing to say about C.S. Lewis's fiction is that at its heart, it is not what so many readers assume, at least at the outset, it is going to be. C.S. Lewis is often referred to as a great Christian author, a great Christian fantasist, and the presumption on the part of many readers is that he is setting out to write these stories in order to teach Christian religious truths, in order to preach, so to speak, the Christian message to the modern world. This is not quite correct. We'll come back to this and develop that point. But I want to say at the outset that my point, my primary observation with respect to Lewis's fiction, in particular, we'll be looking at his Chronicles of Narnia and the trilogy, but my primary point is going to be that Lewis has a project underway in these books. He is attempting. It's a bold attempt, it's pretty daring, but he's attempting a kind of rehabilitation of the modern imagination. In a sense, before or prior to any kind of religious messaging, Lewis is after a reshaping of the modern imagination. Well, we might ask, why is the modern imagination in need of rehabilitation? And that is its own rather lengthy discussion. Suffice it to say that modernity, in its important ideas, as well as in its lived experience, is, at least in Lewis's view, and a view with which I'm very sympathetic, is very hard on the imagination. We live in an age of rapid change, of highly mediated experience, and endless distractions. These things really do wound, perhaps even cripple, the imagination. Now, what I mean by this, I hope, will become clear as we progress through this discussion of the fiction. But I should probably say at first what I mean by imagination. I don't mean creativity. I don't mean ability to come up with, you know, fancy things like, I'm going to imagine a kitten with a unicorn's horn. Ooh, I'm being very imaginative. No, no, no. I don't mean anything like that at all. I mean something like the default settings, if I can steal from the world of computers, the default settings with which we look at the world and with which we attempt to understand it, enter into it, apprehend and grasp what's really going on in the world. So the imagination is sort of precognitive, not strictly, and I'm not speaking philosophically now, but it's the approach that we have to things in general. When you look at something, how do you tend to see it? When you think about something such as, how do I come to know a thing? What does knowing a thing mean to you without even reflecting on it? What does it mean to you to know something? All of this we'll talk about as we develop, but that's what I mean by the imagination, a kind of default setting that that is antecedent to our discursive thinking about things. And as I say, Lewis is trying to work on that because he thinks that's gone astray. He knows that change tends to confuse default settings, rapid change, successive change. Notice how he mentions in the passage I just read this business of successive moments. More importantly, perhaps, I mentioned mediated experience. That's a fancy pants phrase. What does that mean? By that, I simply mean that our ordinary experience now is in a kind of man-made cocoon. We spend most of our lives interacting with things that we have created ourselves, not the natural world, the world of God's own creation. And that also has an effect on how we sort of what we presuppose about things, how we approach things and look at them. And of course, endless distraction. I don't think in a computer age I need explain that point at all. Lewis was writing prior to the computer age, but not prior to the age of radio and automobiles and a technologized, rapidly moving and ever more distracting world. So I think that one's pretty easy to grasp. But what do I mean by rehabilitate? What's he trying to do with the imagination? First, Lewis is trying to resensitize it to what ought to be wonderful, but now is regarded as stale. It's simply true that things that might perhaps be marvelous in them of themselves, if they become too commonplace, too taken for granted, can strike us as stale. And so our wonder at those wonderful things needs some kind of reawakening. That's what he's up to. He's trying to restore a sense of mystery to our experience of even ordinary things. For Lewis, in a sense, there is no such thing as an ordinary thing. Thingness itself is astonishing. He was a very down-to-earth man and a very sensible man, a very practical man in many ways, but he realized that the modern imagination tended to take a lot of stuff for granted, and we should perhaps be a little bit more appreciative of the wonders of ordinary reality. Again, more about all these things as we go on. Lewis wants to restore awareness and sensitivity specifically to certain ancient and medieval archetypes and mythic sources of meaning. The modern imagination is not a mythic imagination. It tends to depersonalize and render the world into a sort of two-dimensional filament that lacks the personality and character that even the pagans saw in a world where there are naiads and dryads and beings sort of occupying even the natural things. In this way, Lewis is a little bit like Wordsworth, who says, I would rather be a pagan, suckled in a creed outworn, so might I, standing on this pleasantly, have glimpses that would make me less forlorn. The modern glimpse of the world is a pretty forlorn one. It's just stuff and matter. And Lewis thinks that we need to sort of reanimate our perception of the world with some of the not the pagan deities per se, but with a kind of mythic sensitivity to a very meaningful world, meanings that we access through mythic structures and sources. He wants to liberate the imagination from addiction to those superficial excitements that are so easily multiplied by technology. Again, I think that's pretty self-explanatory, but this is part of his project in rehabilitating our default settings. And then finally, he wants to liberate the imagination from entrapment to the immediate or the merely immediate. That is, especially in a rapidly changing, busy world, we tend to lose sight of higher and highest things, transcendent things. We tend to be immanentized, as philosophers say. We tend to get stuck in the day-to-day, the mundanity, the ordinariness of things overwhelms us. So we need to have a reawakened sense of the presence of the transcendent. Yes, it's a paradox. Lewis is quite fond of paradox. So whether or not Lewis's fiction succeeds in rehabilitating the imagination is another matter. I know people who debate this quite vigorously. There are those who think that creating the alternate worlds he creates works against some of his aims in working on the imagination, but indeed, I do believe this is what he's up to. What can't, I think, be disputed, however, is that the fiction he created simply captured the imagination, and still does, of countless admiring readers. Lewis has created fiction of nearly universal appeal, and it deserves our close attention. Now, in speaking about Lewis's purpose, I have to be very, very careful, because Lewis himself was a little uneasy when people started talking about his purpose in writing these novels. Again, as I mentioned, there's the common perception that Lewis the apologist, the religious apologist, and Lewis the novelist are the same guy. They're doing essentially the same thing, and his novels are just fictional versions of what he does in his nonfiction prose defense of Christianity. There's some truth to this, but not really very much. Lewis himself was something of a contrarian. He is not above deliberately trying to defy expectations, so if he thinks he knows what you expect, he'll probably do something a little bit different. And thus, when he gets around to talking about his own fictional writing, he might be a little sly. He might be a little circuitous, might not tell you entirely what he's up to. But nevertheless, I do think his writings can shed some light on what he is doing in his own art. First of all, he stoutly denied, speaking now of the Chronicles of Narnia, he stoutly denied that they originated out of a desire to illustrate Christian ideas and truths in fictional form. This is from an essay of Lewis's. Some people seem to think that I began by asking myself how I could say something about Christianity to children. This is all pure moonshine. I couldn't write in that way at all. Everything began with images: a faun carrying an umbrella, a queen on a sledge, a magnificent lion. At first, there wasn't even anything Christian about them. That element pushed itself in of its own accord. Well, what does that mean? What does it mean that those elements push themselves in of their own accord? Well, Lewis takes a cue from the Renaissance poet Tasso and speaks of literature as coming from a kind of bifurcated being. That is, writers are sort of two beings wrapped into one. One of those two beings is the author, and the other is the man. The author is the one who simply wishes to create, who feels the urge to bring into being. He works with images, episodes, character, something destined to delight and to which the author must give form. This is the author part of that bifurcated being. But the other part of that bifurcated being is the man. Now, that means just a person, a Christian, a citizen, someone who looks at this fledgling creation and evaluates it. Is it worthwhile? Is this a story worth telling? Are these images worth looking at? What is the meaning? What is the effect that this is likely to have? The two of these then together produce the story, says C.S. Lewis. And indeed, the result does reflect the spiritual perceptions of its writer. So the author just works with images, but it's the man who sees that these images may have a kind of Christian Christian heft and torque with which he can work. In a different essay, he speaks of the moral elements of fiction as arising from the entire character of the whole person creating it. The only moral that is of any value is that which arises inevitably from the whole cast of the author's mind. Let the pictures tell you their own moral, for the moral inherent in them will rise from whatever spiritual roots you have succeeded in striking during the whole course of your life. And as he says elsewhere, the story itself should force its moral upon you. You find out what the moral is by writing the story. So it's important to understand that for Lewis, spiritual and moral significance is embedded in the story itself, but not as an added or extraneous bit of decoration. It's not icing that he drops on top of the thing. It's not even really an ingredient of the stories, but it's a meaning arising out of the very nature of the things presented in the story. Lewis argues that pleasure and delight in stories is not, as we tend to think, a mere product of an exciting plot, or at least not an exciting plot all by itself. It is in the specific kinds of things that occur in the story. Again, not just the event, but the qualities and the atmosphere, what he somewhere calls the weather of the events. These are the things in which we also take delight. So if your hero is going to, say, freeze to death or be in danger of freezing to death, it matters whether the freezing to death is in a walk-in freezer or the North Pole. The quality and character of the thing that happens is as important as what happens. Now, this, by the way, is a lesson I think largely lost in contemporary cinema, certainly in the action and adventure genre, where you have one explosive event after another just hurled at the audience until the audience is almost numb with, overwhelming excitement. Can you be numb with excitement? It's a paradox. But anyway, the cinema seems to have lost that understanding that it is the texture and the atmosphere and the quality of the event that gives it as much meaning as the event itself. So Lewis, for instance, he argues for this point by saying, look, why do people like to reread books? So if there's a surprising occurrence in the book, when you reread it, you're not surprised, but you still are delighted by it. Why? It's because of the quality and the atmosphere, its texture or characteristic, that you still delight in that surprising event. So for Lewis, this is important because that, the quality of things as a source of delight, is also the source of importance and meaning. What I mean by that will become clear in just a moment. In this context, I want to refer again to that opening quotation. In life and art both, as it seems to me, we are always trying to catch in our net of successive moments something that is not successive. See? So you see, it isn't just event, 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 event. What you're really trying to capture is something that rises up out of those events. And what is that something? Again, it's meaning. Authors don't convey meaning like conveying a message. They elicit, they tease out meaning by selecting and giving particular character to events or moments that readers then vicariously experience themselves. Now, this might seem abstract, this might seem abstruse, but stick with me. This is extremely important. In fact, without it, I don't think we really get Lewis. Now, we have to be careful because when we say meaning, like what's the meaning of Lewis's fiction, people tend to confuse meaning with some kind of idea or proposition, some sort of statement that stands in relation to the story the way a letter stands in relation to its envelope. The story just contains the statement. But that's false. That's not what happens with fiction at all. The story conveys its meaning on the level of experience, primarily, which is precisely why this quality that Lewis talks about, these textures, matter and why they're part and parcel of the meaning. They give it particularity. They make it a specific thing, not just a category of things. We're bordering on metaphysical considerations here, but the idea can be stated fairly simply, and it's behind everything Lewis does when he writes fiction. Meaning is embedded in the thisness, the particularity of the experience afforded to the reader. It resists abstraction into some kind of formula. Stories point in the direction of particulars, while formulas tend to point in the direction of great generalities or universals. It is the work of fiction, according to Lewis, to, quote, give us experiences we have never had, and thus, instead of commenting on life, can add to it. Get it? See, it's the point of fiction, Lewis thinks, it's the point of his fiction, not to comment on life, but to add to it, to embed meaning in the particularities of the events and their qualities that he relates. And what in the case of Narnia is added to life? What particular is presented rich in the weather or qualities that are directly experienced by the reader? And the answer is, well, everything, everything. But of course, the great thing that arises up out of those chronicles is that one character who appears in all of them, Aslan, the lion, the Christ-like creator and redeemer of so many characters and perhaps of Narnia itself. Now notice, it's Aslan. It's not the idea of God. It's not the doctrine of God, the notion of divinity. It's a three-dimensional being, so to speak. And the relation of that being to the turmoils, temptations, and victories in the lives of characters much like us, and in fact in the lives of some characters precisely like us. So again, I think it's a mistake to think of the Chronicles as a quaint, comfortable retelling of the Christian history of redemption. Its origins are in visual images, yes. It's not just a retelling, of Christian history, yes, but it's obviously infused with a Christian grasp and understanding of everything. And Lewis understands this, of course, as well, and sees in it a way to circumvent a kind of callous over-familiarity with Christian realities, an over-familiarity that breeds, if not contempt, then at least complacency, the loss of wonder, the loss of joy, the loss of amazement in real things. I mean, think about it. If the Gospels are good news, isn't good news supposed to have something of the character of a surprise? Well, hasn't the world become tired of the Gospels? Hadn't it become tired of them by Lewis's day? Hadn't the surprise gone out? Over familiarity. So, speaking of the child's fairy tale, Lewis then addresses this over familiarity. Again, remember, reconditioning the imagination. Lewis picks the fairy story as his mechanism, so to speak, spurred on, of course, by the images that he had been entertaining really for decades. I thought, Lewis says, I thought I saw how stories of this kind, fairy stories, could steal past a certain inhibition which had paralyzed much of my own religion in childhood. Why did one find it so hard to feel as one was told one ought to feel about God or about the sufferings of Christ? I thought the chief reason was that one was told one ought to. An obligation to feel can freeze feelings. And reverence itself did harm. The whole subject was associated with lowered voices. But supposing by casting all of these things into an imaginary world, stripping them of their stained glass and Sunday school associations, one could make them, for the first time, appear in their real potency. Could not thus one steal past those watchful dragons? I thought one could. So again, the Chronicles are not retellings so much as stories that draw upon the nature of things, of what things are and of how they behave for their moral dynamic, their moral movement, their shape, their torque, and ultimately their particular qualities that bring such weighty generalities to live in very specific beings. From the social clumsiness and vanity of a perky jackdaw to Aslan's correcting wit in an anecdote like in the first joke, Lewis draws his lessons from particular beings rather than drapes moral lessons on top of artificial characters. So let's look at some of those particular facets of nature that Lewis takes up in his images non-abstractions. Well, one doesn't have far to seek, does one? The first is that being, that is existence itself, is received. Things receive their natures. They don't generate themselves. Thus, creation and being created is huge in the Chronicles of Narnia. In fact, there's an entire volume, The Magician's Nephew, dedicated to it. Another one, temptation. What about temptation? It's a remarkably powerful force. It can operate on the passions. It can operate on the will. It can even operate on our reason. And it almost seems, I mean, the Lewis's view of temptation is really quite dark. It almost seems as if you escape the power of temptation, it's a result of either a happy accident or the direct intervention of something Remember the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, how many times characters are tempted and it's the appearance, the sudden appearance or intervention of Aslan that prevents the person from falling into some kind of evil. Like temptation, reformation of character seems to require some kind of intervention from an outside source as well. There is participation in this. There are characters who are involved in their reformation, so to speak, but it always requires an enormous sort of intervention by Aslan or somebody else, Eustace in The Dawn Treader, Edmund in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. These require a kind of transformative suffering on someone else's part, again, in some cases participated in by the sinner himself, but a transformative suffering on the part of someone else in order to reform their character. Along similar lines, and I don't mean to be flip in my manner of referring to it, but another one of these moral dynamisms would be there is no such thing as a moral free lunch. Evils must be atoned. This atonement, by the way, also occurs, as I mentioned, usually outside of the self, ordinarily. What about the nature of heroism, not just the nature of reformation or evil or temptation or the reception of being, but what about something like heroism, of which these stories are full? Well, it's not simple aggressiveness, is it? But in Narnia, it includes a willing to act when the way is not clear, that is the way forward is not clear, and the result is definitely uncertain. This relates, of course, to another one of these natural realities that he embeds in the Chronicles, and that is the reality and, in fact, the inescapability of moral battle in life. Life really is a moral battle. It isn't a relentless pursuit of conveniences and comforts. It is a series of moral skirmishes that sometimes break out into open war. And in such wars, you often have the triumph of the weak or the small over the apparently powerful and great. It's never certain that the weak and the small will be victorious, but it's always necessary for them to make that attempt. One more. This one is especially interesting. Lewis likes to expose the sort of self-imposed nature of moral blindness. Notice how in The Magician's Nephew, even Aslan can do nothing. Aslan can do nothing for the foolish Uncle Andrew. And in the last battle, the silly dwarves, Aslan is powerless to assist or to help. Okay, they are imposing a kind of blindness and insusceptibility to what is real on themselves. As Lewis puts it in a marvelous phrase, really, that I think sums up the modern world in all kinds of ways, they have chosen cunning instead of belief. Well, behind these natural dynamisms of the moral universe that we see at work in the Chronicles, there are a couple of underlying themes that I would like to highlight as well. And by underlying, I don't mean just underlying. I mean integrating and uniting. These things that I just mentioned could perhaps be described as a list of preachy features rather than an exhibition of great dynamism unless they were unified in some ways. And I think there are numbers of ways in which they're unified. The first of these, again, has a moral quality. And that is, beneath the various virtues and vices on generous display, there's what we might call a kind of spectrum. At one end of the spectrum is what might be called, simply enough, gratitude, or recognition of the gratuity of what has been given. I'll develop this in just a moment. At the other end of the spectrum is what might be called presumption, a kind of, again, insusceptibility to the wondrousness of everything that is. The presumption that the world just is what it is and getting all you can for yourself is, frankly, the order of the day. So there's the spectrum, gratitude, wondrous awe at the great good of existing, of being given life, and of all the things around you, and presumption, taking it for granted, insusceptibility to wonder, and assuming stuff just is what it is, and your job, my job, our job is just to get what you can, baby. Move out, into it, aggrandize, amass, get as much as you can. Now, this might sound like that latter presumption might sound more like greed, and many of the vices and evils on display certainly do reflect in the Chronicles a kind of debilitating selfishness, sure. But the lack of gratitude is what is behind that selfishness. The assumption that the world is just out there awaiting exploitation by the cunning and the ruthless, or the sufficiently cunning and the ruthless, this is what's behind that vice. It's an irreverent presumption, because it does not consider that the world, and see, Lewis is sensitive to this point, the world need not be the way that it is at all. In fact, it need not even be. Life in a world that is a gratuitous gift for Lewis is to be sculpted. You sculpt such a life. You do not amass it. It all depends on recognition of the gift. Everything does. So clearly, this underlying conception militates against the tendency in the modern world to regard ourselves as masters of everything, that is, including our own natures, and that we can do with existence whatever our will dictates. You can see, I think, how Lewis's emphasis will militate against that. The next great conception might be called that of discovery. Look, think about the whole series. Think about all the Chronicles. Notice how Lewis's characters are forever finding new places, new kinds of beings, new things. Not only are his main characters often children, but discovery, when you think about it, is actually the real vocation and condition of the child. For a child susceptible to wonder, discovery reveals things new, things fresh, and yes, often things dangerous. This is the mode of the Chronicles. Discovery, new, fresh, and dangerous. In this context, think of the passage. In fact, if Lewis were here, I would ask him, could not this passage from Scripture act as an epigram for the entire Chronicles? Lest you become like little children, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Most of the time, people read that as a kind of silly moral platitude. Maybe not silly, even if they're sympathetic with it. They think of it in very shallow terms. It just means aren't being sweet and nice and innocent and presumably dribbling chocolate all down your front. That's what it takes to get you into the kingdom of heaven. But if you think about it in terms of the Chronicles of Narnia, not at all. It points to what children do. They discover. They take chances. They explore. And they range in the world in a constant hunger for its wonders. That's the mode. That's the vocation of the child. And that's what Lewis's characters do all over in the Chronicles. Remember, Aslan is not safe, but he is good. He is dangerous and frightening, but good. Children encounter the good, when you think about it, children encounter the good not as the comfortable and safe. It's adults who like to associate the idea of safe with good, not children. A child's idea of the good is something attractive and marvelous, and usually kind of perilous, like Aslan. So related to discovery, that underlying theme in the entire series of novels, related to that is the next conception, which is really more of an image than a conception. Notice how often the novels are filled with passages to new places. Wardrobes, doorways, paintings, railway stations, places that open up to another world. In one novel, there is even an entire forest dedicated to openings up to other worlds. It's called The Woods, The Wood Between the Worlds. This is all very well, and people often appreciate the childlike adventure implicit in such passageways. But it matters very much that these passageways link things. They pull things together. The worlds are not just out there. They're connected. They're attached. Now, the very opening of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, for instance, draws attention to the professor's old, mysterious house, one filled with passages and doorways. There are any amount of stairs and passages in the house, and the Pevensey children recognize that the place is perfect for exploration and discovery. Now, it's true that it gives them a little bit of a creepy feeling, but notice how they push right through the creepy feeling and explore anyway. So what? What about passages? Well, this really constitutes, I think, it's not just a quaint or cute thing. It constitutes a fundamental effort of the novels. They're not just avenues of adventure. They constitute links and integrations. Let me explain why this business of links is important. And to do that, I'll use an historical example. Many others could be generated. In the late 17th century, sorry to be very pedantic, but this is a course, right? So I'm allowed to be a little pedantic. I'm a pedant, after all. So in the late 17th century, there was a very vigorous discussion about the nature of what was called wit and whether a good mind, what characterized a good mind? Was it really good at distinguishing things, distinguishing between things, or was it in seeing likenesses in things? Was a good mind a mind that took things apart, analysis, dissection, atomization, or was a good mind a mind that pulled things together in synthesis, composition, integration? I know that all sounds very abstract, but stick with me. The overwhelming answer modernity has made to that question is the former. Knowledge is in separating things, distinguishing things, analyzing things. If I go to a student, if I go to into a class and say, all right, guys, you're going to write a paper analyzing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, all the students would go, They're comfortable. If I walked in and I said, okay, guys, you're all going to write a paper synthesizing The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, they you know, what? What do you mean? What do you mean? It's one of our default settings, again, in the imagination. Analysis and the separation of things is what constitutes wisdom and knowledge. Lewis knows better. He's a student of the classical world and the medieval world and the early Renaissance. He knows very well that synthesis is of value as well, at least as much as is analysis. So in placing access, passageways, and avenues to connection at the very heart of the Chronicles, Lewis attempts to wrest the modern imagination out of the clutches of what really is a kind of superstition, the demotion of integration and connections, which constitute, as I said, which constitutes discovery as well, the demotion of those things to a point of inconsiderability. This attempt to correct the modern imagination occupies much of his work, but here we see it figures in the creation of many worlds and they're being linked, okay? And by being linked, I mean there's movement possible between them. So I will move now towards some concluding remarks. I would like, if I had time, to discuss more about the moral dynamics of the work. In those dynamics, we see some of the particulars and some of the characters and their personalities come into more full display, but we'll have to pass over those and move to a few remarks that I think might serve as our conclusion. These stories, the stories of Narnia, however one accounts for their relation to the world, attempt, as I say, to renew our imaginative susceptibility to the deep magic or the deep structures of meaning inherent in our world. Lewis thinks they're really real, these meanings. We have grown cold in our complacent and scientific mastery of the world, and our imaginations now lack the capacity to wonder at a given nature and account ourselves beholden to that given nature. This is not how we tend to think. So by scripting narratives of discovery, of reconnection, and the high moral good of a being fundamentally grateful for existence, Lewis invites his readers to leave the worst facets of modernity behind and relish the wonder that comes of seeing what things really are. The continuous, that is, so what are things? Well, things, nature, being, is the continuous singing forth of the universe by a good but not safe God. Thank you.